I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 30th of June. The cover of June's Scientific American has a picture of a human brain and the headline, "The Neuroscience of Habits, How They Form and Why They Are So Hard to Change." Good habits, bad habits, researchers are pinpointing the brain circuits that can help us form good habits and break bad ones. This hour of the program, the co-author of the article, Professor Kyle Smith, Assistant Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Dartmouth College, will be welcoming phone calls. Think about the number of habitual behaviors that you have every day and wonder how you got them. Do you find that some of them might be destructive, not very good for your health, or others might be just terrific in making you a very smart and very healthy person? Why do we have them? How can we get them? How do we get rid of some of them? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Professor Kyle Smith, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, my pleasure.
Yeah. So how many habits do we all of us have during the course of a day? Are there hundreds of them or just a couple?
Well, I'd suggest we have a couple major ones. You know, driving a familiar route to work might be one of those. And the ways we go about, I guess, grooming or prepping ourselves in the morning would be another. But, you know, probably we're filled with probably hundreds of mini ones. Everyone's probably got their own little pet rituals they go through. I pick my nails and stuff like that. You know, so it's hard to put a number on. Each person is different. But I would say, you know, a lot of our day is probably, you know, habits creep in pretty pervasive.
And I guess I never really thought of habits as being a good or a bad thing. I mean, obviously, some are bad. But I never had thought of them particularly as being a good thing. We have habits that are good for us.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. And that's, you know, arguably why we have them at all, is because they can be pretty beneficial. You know, classically, what everyone thinks is that what they basically let you do is to, once you've learned something and figured out how to do it in a way that works, is to kind of free up your mind, free up resources, free up brain energy to think about other things or to do other things or multitask. You know, again, driving the car is a good one. You don't want to be constantly processing all the information that you see. You know, as anyone remembers when they first learned to drive, you know, it's difficult. You have to, there's just a lot of things to pay attention to. But it's nice once you get a lot of practice with that to sort of go on autopilot and basically let the habit sort of system take control so you can do, you know, other things.
Mm. On the other hand, maybe I've just done too many talk shows, but I can recall somebody saying, well, it strengthens all the circuitry in your brain if you take different ways to work. So I try to do that as often as possible.
Yeah, true enough. And my wife does that too. I'm completely the opposite. I like to let my mind wander a bit. But, you know, even that aside, I'm sure you're not aware of all the little minutia things that your hands wind up doing, and you're pressing the gas and the brakes, you know, and reacting to lights and stuff like that. So still, even in that case, I'd suggest you're probably a good deal operating by sort of habit.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned being on sort of an autopilot. Is there something that happens, and we've made so many advances in studying and looking at the human brain now, is there something that happens that kind of shuts down the brain and gives it a bit of a rest when we're on autopilot driving to work or doing something kind of rote?
Yeah, that's a really ongoing sort of hot research question. And, you know, what I can say is that, you know, a lot of, you know, what we think of the prefrontal cortex, the big system for thinking and planning, does tend to probably shut down. And, you know, the areas in the brain it's connected to seem to as well. And we've been actually able to pick up on some of that in, you know, animal studies where we can look at neural recordings, and in humans they've been looking at brain imaging patterns. And that sort of statement holds pretty true. You know, the systems we think of as important for, you know, actively engaging in the world tend to get quieter, and those important for, you know, the sort of behavioral aspects of things, doing something in a repeated way, tend to strengthen at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What have we learned about the images from the brain recently that have made the whole study of habits, good or bad, encouraging them or breaking them have brought it front and center and given us a better understanding.
So recently, I would say in the last decade, there's really been a great sort of explosion of research on the topic. And this owes a lot to what we talk about a bit in the article. People have developed sort of definitions of how to understand habits and what to measure, you know, and when people are doing things. And so what that's led to is this sort of parallel, I guess, surge of animal research where we can, you know, do manipulations of the brain to pick it apart, and also human imaging. And I think what's emerged is that we've been able to sort of isolate a lot of the critical brain areas for controlling habits that, you know, without these or when these aren't quite active enough, behavior never really becomes a habit. And at the same time, we've sort of found this kind of parallel network that's, as I mentioned earlier, important for, you know, being online, really thinking about what you're doing, and finding that, you know, lo and behold, that kind of shuts down too. So I think, you know, as usually with science, we're finding that things are far more complex than just a, you know, a habit brain area coming on, that it involves sort of changes across the brain. And that's been one of the major, I think, advances in the last few years is showing how that happens.
What is the difference between a habit and an addiction?
Right, yeah, that's a main interest of mine, actually. And so a habit is, I would suggest that addiction involves a habit. Habit's one component of that. An addiction sort of has these extra features where there's this, especially with drugs, you know, this craving element, and it's almost, you know, a desire that you have no control over, even if you want to stop. Whereas the habits, you tend to sort of only be aware of them after you've carried them out. So the habits and the brain areas we know to be important for habits are lighting up, you know, in addicts, shown pictures of drugs and things like that. But also in addiction, there's other brain areas that are important for processing motivations and desires and, you know, thinking about the future that are implicated. So addiction seems to be sort of a bigger problem that involves, in part, some of the habit activity that we see.
Mm-hmm. You may want to tell us about some of the experiments that have been done that you feature in the article, the rat experiment.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's sort of several. And why don't I start with recording the brain activity. Yeah, so we had rats run a maze, and it's shaped like a T. And so it runs down the alleyway, and then it hears a tone, a sound, telling him to turn left or right. And if he does it correctly, he'll get a little chocolate reward. And what we had found is that behaviorally, animals could learn the task pretty quickly, but then if we changed the value of that chocolate reward, made it so the animal didn't want it anymore, then he would pretty quickly stop going for it. But if the animal was overtrained day after day after day, he'd keep going for this stuff, even though he really wanted nothing to do with it at all once he got there. So we had that sort of timeline where we could see behavior shift from sort of a more purposeful pattern to one that was habitual. And then so we went in with this new technology where it let us record the activity of the brain cells over months of time in a couple different areas we think to be important for habits. And what we found was, in one, that the brain activity developed sort of a pattern that really accentuated the beginning and the end of runs. And this, we had sort of thought, may have a lot to do with how sort of the sequences of the behavior sort of packaged together into a unit, almost like we chunk together our phone numbers in memory, you know, memorizing little bits of it, and that once you start it, it sort of plays out by itself. And then I guess the last part of that was that we recorded this other brain area and found that it remarkably did the same thing. It developed the same exact pattern almost, but it did so later. And it really only changed just as the animal went into this sort of habit mode of running for this sort of bad chocolate milk. And so we thought that might be a really important mechanism for sort of the final trigger of something sort of popping up as a habit.
Hmm. I'm wondering if we learn things as children, we're eating a certain kind of food, we're making sure that we take a walk after dinner, or we're doing something that's not very good for us, and that stays with us. We hear that we learn languages, and it's easier to learn things when you're young. Do we also get our habits, and it's harder to break them, good or bad, if they're put in our minds when we're four?
That's probably true. I have a four-year-old right now.
Oh, you do? Oh.
But, yeah, the you know, the developing brain is very what we call plastic. It's very changeable, and it changes constantly. And so that's part of the reason why most people don't have great memories of when they were very young, is because so much has changed that the memory is kind of gone. So my guess is there's sort of a critical window in adolescence where habits can be imprinted pretty easily, and that stick around. And that's, you know, classically a time of big vulnerability to drug addiction and things like that, incidentally. But also, you know, during this time, habits that form can, you know, be broken. You know, if a four-year-old sucks his or her thumb a lot, it's a period where we can go, you know, train the person and provide a lot of reinforcement for not doing that. And it's a period where habits can also be broken, I think, easily as well.
Mm. It's a funny thing. I used to love to suck my thumb, and
yeah.
I was even offered a bicycle if I would stop, and I said, no, thank you.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that in a long time, but, man, that was a hard one to break.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And it, you know, it's hard to reinforce those. You know, the reward has to be good enough, and, you know, if you're a kid, there's really no downside to sucking your thumb. You can't think about the teeth problems you might have.
Right, right.
You know, I guess part of the thing.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about habits this hour, and it's interesting to just think about the habits that you have in your daily life and those you like and those you'd like to get rid of, and the line, if there is one, between habit and addictions, and how you may change a habit or get into a healthy habit. What is it that we've learned about what's going on in the brain during those routine things that we do every day that make habit good for us or make it bad for us, and what happens within the brain? Our guest this hour is co-author of a piece in the current issue of Scientific American, The Neuroscience of Habits, How They Form and Why They Are So Hard to Change. Here's how you get a hold of us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Kyle Smith is our guest. Kyle is an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Ed is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Kathleen. Nice to meet you. Hello to you as well, the other gentleman on the phone. I have a question. When I was a teenager, I'm 30 now. When I was a teenager, I had the tendency to go out to parties on the weekends, and I would drink heavily. And then that kind of spiraled out of control, and I eventually ended up, you know, being considered what's called an alcoholic. And I did AA and all that, and just really nothing seemed to work. But, you know, with the habit thing is that I feel that I turned into an alcoholic from constantly being in social situations and then having to drink. And then that just kind of bloomed into something totally radically different, where I was, you know, drinking during the week on Monday mornings, things like that. It was pretty nasty. But then one day, all of a sudden, I just kind of stopped. It was just totally just done. You know, I was like, I'm done with this. I need to move on with my life. And then, you know, it just stopped. I wonder if there what the correlation is there, or is that common? Is that, or am I just a weird case?
No, it's amazing you could do that, I think, to just stop.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great question. So, you know, initially a lot of these addictions and habits in general develop in certain contexts and really only happen there, but then they can certainly spill over into other contexts, especially, you know, if you have liquor bottles at your house, for example, and see those and you start craving it and then go through the motions. You know, as far as stopping, you know, I'd say it's absolutely fabulous that happened, and it may, you know, sometimes be a consequence of, you know, the negative outcomes, you know, building up and being so powerful enough finally that you're able to stop. The real you know, trouble with addiction is that, you know, when there is successful people being able to stop themselves, especially through rehab programs and things like that, there's still this lingering vulnerability to sort of slip back in. And this is, you know, classically true of pretty much all habits in general, that they're never really gone. They can be suppressed or replaced by healthier things. It seems from what we know in the studies so far that that's true of addiction as well. So there's, the downside is that there's still some vulnerability in most people that have stopped, but the plus side is that with some successful, you know, history of knowing how to stop and the conditions under which you're able to keep, you know, withholding from that, that using that, you know, what works for you to avoid that stuff and avoiding certainly the triggers and the context associated with it can be really beneficial.
If you wanted to develop a beneficial habit, like say every day after dinner you were going to walk for a mile inside or outside, how long would it take and how often would you have to repeat the behavior, do you think, Professor Smith, to have your brain decide that this is a habit and it's a good one?
Yeah, I mean, that'll depend entirely on the individual. But I think what we've learned a lot is that, as I mentioned, you know, habits develop in context, and certainly they are triggered by cues. And so there's an anecdote we write about of, you know, someone that wants to jog, for example, putting out the jogging shoes so you actually see them. They're in your face time of day. And that really, you know, can be enough to get going.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as, you know, the time it takes to do it, you know, probably, you know, a habit is going to sort of take root over the course of many, many days, possibly months. And the idea is to just keep giving yourself those triggers and even some positive, you know, sort of consequences. A, you know, a treat of ice cream or something after you've done it can help. But if you do that over and over again, I think, you know, within some time frame, weeks or months, that you form this new sort of habit that's part of yourself now. And that's really, I think, how healthy habits can be built.
Yes. Well, carry on, Ed. Great news, and thank you so much for calling. Alyssa in Greenfield. Hi.
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 So I have a question regarding genetics and behavior. You had mentioned habitual versus purposeful behavior, and I was just wondering if, you know, what if you could expound on the genetic aspect of it?
Sure.
Or if there is any.
Yeah. I think the evidence is kind of slim at the moment, but I would suggest there's going to be a big explosion with the new sort of technologies we have. But what we do know is that there are certainly individuals, even laboratory rats, have, you know, individual personalities that make them more or less likely to form habits in tasks. And once you have that, you can start looking at what the sort of genetic differences are. And a lot of it's converged onto differences in signaling of a neurotransmitter called dopamine, which some people may have heard of. It's important not only for, you know, I guess the good feelings or motivations that we have, but also for sort of stamping things in as something to repeat in the future. And so people that have sort of gene polymorphisms associated with excessive function of these dopamine chemicals and its receptors tend to have sort of a greater proclivity towards developing habits, and that's certainly been true in studies of drug addiction as well. So that's one, the dopamine receptor. I've seen some studies about opioids as well as another neurochemical, and you know, as far as I understand the literature, there's not a whole lot more than that, but I sort of see that being a big research target.
Thanks, Alyssa, for your call. Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is totally on topic, but it's something I've been curious about for a long time, is that I experience and does, and numerous other people I've spoken to experience that the shower, when taking a shower, it seems solutions to problems that you've been thinking about will pop into your head, or creative new ideas will pop into the head. So the showering seems to be a generator of new creative ideas.
Sure.
Do you have any insights into that?
So your showers are pretty long, Stella?
No, No, actually, they're pretty short.
Oh, really? So they just pops in?
Yeah, and it just seems, I don't know whether it has something to do with the water running, if there's negative ions, or, you know, if it's, I have no idea, but it happens very frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my, I'm just sort of speculating, I guess, but I haven't run any shower studies myself. But, you know, I have the exact same experience. And, you know, it's actually, it's funny, you go through sort of your ritualistic showering procedures, and I often find myself wondering, did I wash my hair? I assume I did at this stage, you know, but I don't remember doing it. So anyways, I think, you know, a shower and those kind of closed room activities are places where everything is completely familiar, and you've done it over and over and over again. There's no surprises, distractions, anything like that. And so this may, you know, well be a case, you know, where you can really just go offline and let of your rituals that you've built take over. And that's, I think, a great example, at least, of, you know, how the brain can go on autopilot once it's done something again and again, and there's nothing new to pay attention to. And what happens then is that your, you know, mind starts wandering. You start, you know, doing problem solving or creative thinking, and that I think underscores one of the big advantages of having habits is that it lets your mind, you know, do other things that aren't just, you know, in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Stella, so much for your call. We have some lines open if you've been trying to get through. Our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about habits this hour of the program. It's the cover story for Scientific American for the month of June, and one of the authors of the piece is with us, Kyle Smith, assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College. Feel free to join the conversation by phone or any of the other ways you can use to get a hold of us. Marcus in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I just realized I have tons of habits. Maybe I'm even ritualistic, but I have a habit that's gone back 15 or 20 years. I began muting commercials on TV while watching a Packer game. They had all the beer commercials. And the commercials, it just felt like they were penetrating my brain. I don't know if it's, you know, my OCD or whatever the heck. But anyway, now I live alone. My daughters are all grown up, and I visit them. When I'm at someone else's house, I don't mind the commercials because there's all these distractions. But when I'm at home, I have public radio on in the background, and I just casually mute them. I know when the commercials are coming up, and I want to brag about one thing. The last presidential election, I never listened to one single commercial.
Oh, my goodness.
I was very proud of that. Yeah, because they're just, I don't know, the commercials just affect me. It's like an intrusion or something. So is that a habit, or, you know, what the heck's going on there, please?
Sure. You know, commercials, I guess in that case, would be something you didn't sign up for when you had watched a show or a sporting event or listened to the radio station. And, you know, in that sense, you're taking control over what's, the sensory input you're getting, which is great. And, you know, at a more fundamental level, I think, generally people just, and all animals really just sort of like familiarity and control over things. And, that may be one example of that playing out with the commercials and stuff like that. But, you know, they like things being predictable. I mean, some people are daredevils and adventurous in aspects of their lives. But, for when you're sitting down to relax and would like, you know, not to be inundated with, you know, things, commercials and advertisements and people telling you what to do, I think that's one way this might be playing out.
Mm-hmm. That's why if you have cable, you get that thing where you can just get rid of all the commercials. It's terrific.
Right. Yeah.
It's amazing they allowed that to happen, I have always thought, but isn't it great?
Yeah. They're finding other ways to pop up.
How true. They sure are. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The article says, and again, talking about addictions and habits, extreme forms of habit may be involved in autism and schizophrenia, in which repetitive, overly used behaviors are a problem. Do we know anything more than just that about this, how it could develop into autism and schizophrenia, and what the link is and why?
Sure. This is another very ongoing research question, but what we're finding is some of the same brain networks that we know are important for, you know, forming normal habits, in the case of the maze running in the animal I mentioned, They seem to also become engaged and probably dysfunctional in these disorders. And we can also include, I mentioned drug addiction, but also OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder would be another one. And what, you know, all these have in common is sort of this ritualistic, repetitive mode of behavior. Each disorder has its own, you know, distinct features, autism having a major social recognition and social participation issue, and OCD having a major anxiety component, and so on. But nevertheless, you know, one common feature is this sort of stuck in this ritualistic pattern of behavior that, you know, is almost an obsession, and you just do it again and again, and it becomes problematic in those cases because it interferes with your ability to go about your life. It becomes unhealthy. And so, you know, when we look in the brains of patients suffering from these disorders, oftentimes we'll see hyperactivity in the striatum. It's one area of the basal ganglia that we study. We'll also see, in animal models that sort of have some gene mutations and show up as sort of showing these exaggerated repetitive behaviors. There's one kind that animals obsessively groom. This was a study done by Eric Bergier, a good friend of mine. But finding, again, that sort of obsessive repetitive behavior is recruiting the same brain areas for normal habits. And in that case, you know, being a dysfunction of how the cells are normally supposed to be working.
Mm-hmm. And are we getting our animals, or are we getting any sense of satisfaction from that? I'm interested when you talk about self-grooming. There must be something that otherwise we wouldn't do it all the time.
I think so. You know, I guess there's two sorts of satisfaction. One would be, you know, what's characteristic of OCD would be, you know, an anxiety if you don't do a behavior, and
mm-hmm.
a relief kind of thing. But there's also, you know, a lot of evidence, and I'm a big proponent of this idea, that the behaviors themselves almost become like the goal. You know, when I mentioned the rat running the maze, it was trying to find chocolate, and when we drive our cars, trying to find work and so forth. But in some cases, maybe the action, you know, is itself sort of soothing or rewarding or comforting. It has like a value sort of that works on its own. And that may, you know, be one thing the striatum area is contributing to behaviors. And it makes some sense why the behaviors can sort of pop out as just they make no sense. They have no outcome other than just doing them themselves.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Angela in Hayward. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question that I have pertains to how well the data in animal models and, for example, how those habits are made or broken translates to humans. And I ask this because, you know, we have three cats, and obviously sometimes I look and they're clearly habits that they have that I wish that they didn't. and I just wonder what sorts of differences you have to apply when talking about breaking bad behaviors of humans. Besides, you know, obviously you're going to need a better level of treat. But you know, what learnings have you gotten in terms of what you see in animals that does carry over into people or not, as the case may be?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a big sort of divide in brain research that. You know, understanding human brains, but using, you know, animals like rats as a model for that, which obviously don't have the same brain. But they do have a nearly identical sort of below the cortex network, and the basal ganglia being a major one for habits. And it really is pretty homologous between the species. So we have just by itself some confidence that what we find would apply to humans as well. And, you know, it's a back and forth kind of thing where we'll go in with animal models and do brain recordings, as I mentioned, and we've also done, me and many other labs have done manipulations where we can turn on or turn off brain cells to directly test, you know, what we think the activity is doing for a habit. And at the same time, you know, you have people studying humans and finding the same brain areas lighting up at, you know, in similar conditions or times of learning a habit. And so what you wind up with in the end is sort of a nice piece together story of similar things happening in the animal world as well as in humans. And, you know, in the future, I see it more directly linked with human technologies have been developed that are able to sort of perturb activity in certain brain areas. And so I see this as a new way to sort of test how well the link between the animal research and humans is. But yeah, for a lot of these brain areas, it's quite close. I think once we get to the level of the cortex, it becomes a little more tenuous because the humans have such a more sort of multifaceted level of the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Angela. I'd give you a chance to talk more, but your phone is kind of garbled, so that wouldn't be good because we couldn't hear you. I think it's fascinating to look at. It's a source of endless amusement to me. Maybe it's a break from reading books or whatever else needs to be done, but to look at dogs and my dog's habits and how they pertain, there are different kinds of habits that are associated with each individual in the house, so he's kind of read who we are in a sense. But he goes through the day doing these entirely predictable things, and I just, although they're tailor-made, you know, for each one of us, and it's just fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the laboratory animals are no different. I mean, they almost look exactly like what humans do. It's very familiar behavior.
Oh, my.
And each one, you know, each animal is, like each dog is different, and it forms its own, you know, habits based on its context and environment it's been in.
But the
similarities are remarkable, and I have to, you know, my mind immediately jumps to the really striking similarity of this sort of basal ganglia network that all these animals have really in common, and where we think the sort of the seed of habits are.
Let's go next to Alex in Madison. Hi, Alex.
Hi. So I was wondering about, and I know you've talked a little bit about this, but, you know, the threshold between a cognitive process where you're, like, thinking critically or, you know, being creative and the habit. For example, I read the Internet every night, you know, as I'm going to bed, and every time it's a little bit different, of course, but at the same time, it's, like, very clearly a habit. So I wonder if you could just go into that a little more.
Yeah, sure. I think in reality it's sort of an interplay of these systems, a lot of behaviors. Have elements of habits and elements of more cognitive sort of active thinking. But one thing we do know about habits that's really surprised us is that they have some sort of kind of flexibility in how they play out. I guess one familiar example might be, as I mentioned, driving to work. You're able to stop at red lights and so forth. You're not just driving a route on autopilot. You're able to process things, but perhaps have no memory that you've done it afterwards. And so these brain areas, what we've seen is that, as I mentioned, most of the cells sort of develop this sort of pattern of sort of chunking together the behavior as a whole. But there's also other types of cells just intermixed in there that tend to respond to each element of a task. And what this lets you do is sort of change up the conditions. You can put in new cues or new information or new instructions, and the animal is able to sort of maintain sort of an overall representation of what it's doing while showing a little flexibility. And so this is all happening at the level of what we think of as the habit network. And so, you know, in your case, you know, it's probably a mix of that. You have this sort of overall, I guess, scheme of a habit of what you're doing, and within that, the sort of subtleties or details can change around. And, you know, perhaps at some level, some of the cognitive systems might be involved too when something engages your interest or is surprising.
Thank you, Alex, for your call. Lisa Hayward, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about food and habits, and if our peers and family are influencing our food habits, how can we change those? Is it harder? Do we need to get, like, hang out with new people if we want to make a change, if our friends and family aren't changing along with us?
So this would be eating habits, like healthy eating?
Healthy eating?
Yeah, if we're trying to make a change for the better.
Uh-huh. Sure. I would, you know, unfortunately suggest that that's part of it. The, you know, unhealthy eating is a tough one because just the taste of bad foods is pretty strong, and so the more you do it, the more you go to McDonald's and things like that, or not to victimize or make them the bad guy, but unhealthy fatty foods or sugary foods, the more you do it, the more you wind up doing it again. And the social interaction thing is very real and maybe somewhat uniquely human, how we can transfer those habits across individuals and across social groups. But nevertheless, it almost, you can lump that together as sort of a context or an environment or a cue or a trigger for different types of patterns of behavior, and that to really change those things, you almost would have to either have a really strong amount of willpower to override, you know, those pressures, or else somehow change the group dynamic, or else avoid it entirely when you're hungry or something like that. Because social pressures almost act like an environment in which you sort of build these patterns of unhealthy eating in this case, and they wind up carrying out, you know, as a consequence of that environment.
Well, the advice usually given if you're going to start an exercise campaign, all these magazines will say, get a buddy. You're going to be much more effective if you're doing workouts together. So I would assume it would hold true for food, too. Get a healthy eating buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that can be enough positive reinforcement, as well as, you know, a trigger. You know, you've set a schedule, and that's enough. That's like the sight of your running shoes, I guess. and it makes a big difference. We're very social, you know, creatures, and you know, having either a support network or someone actively, you know, going through the same plan as yourself can really, really help dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Lisa?
I wonder how that would change with cultures, and like maybe a certain culture may have an emphasis on peer relationships more so than maybe another culture might have a value of great independence and kind of going your own way and making your own choices at the store. I think it's just maybe a larger influence than we think about when we think about food environment.
I'm sure that's true. You know, most of the, you know, the actual research studies on the topic have been done in Western cultures, but the smaller cultures and the Eastern cultures is probably different, and even, you know, within the United States, different cultures or classes, I'm sure, would have different group dynamics. That would absolutely be part of it, and the story, you know, as usual, is far more complex than probably just having social pressure being good or bad or there at all. We'll have to flesh that out with time.
Thank you, Lisa, for your call. We'll take more in a moment. This hour, we're talking about habits. The co-author of a piece in Scientific American this month titled The Neuroscience of Habits, How They Form and Why They Are So Hard to Change. Professor Kyle Smith, Assistant Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Dartmouth College, is our guest this hour, and we have a couple lines open. Should you be wanting to join us, here's how you do it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Anita in Gurnee. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to, go along with that earlier lady that said that she gets, you know, really good thoughts and clarity in the shower. Well, that happens to me, too, but also when I'm washing dishes. And I always thought it was because you're doing something that really doesn't require much of your brain. And then your brain goes to other things. It's like a clear pathway. But besides that, I wanted to let you know that many years ago I went to a retreat given by Joan Anderson, and it was for women, and it was about becoming an unfinished woman and embracing change as something good and not resisting it so much. And I know that has really, really helped me a lot in minor things as well as big things. But I get very frustrated when I have a friend that complains about how tough something is, and I'll say, well, here's another way. Why don't you say this? Oh, I can't. And if I say, why not? Then she'll say, well, because this is the way I always do it. So I think sometimes people don't know why logically they persist in doing something the same way all the time. It's so important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. That sort of underscores the main kind of question about how the brain does habits and what we can do about that. Yeah, I mean, the dishwashing example is perfect. It's something that you know how to do. You've done over and over again. And, you know, the habit network in the brain really just sort of takes over and does it for you. And the other parts of your brain sort of, you know, work on their own. But, so the other question or comment, I guess, related to, you know, why do we fall, I guess, into what we're familiar with and resist change? And, you know, I guess as far as we understand the brain, it's sort of, I guess, a bit disheartening, but it's happening at a lot of different levels, one of which is that, you know, if you've done something by habit over and over again and that's an option, like if you're in a certain context, it tends to play out that way. That tends to be what you want to do and what you wind up doing. And the other question, I guess, is, you know, in terms of willpower and interest in changing and people's ability to sort of weigh the different courses of action and sort of longer-term goals or distant goals, that, you know, is sort of a separate brain process, certainly at the level of the prefrontal cortex I mentioned and all of its circuits. And, you know, if that's going offline, as the habit's being triggered, it's sort of a 1-2 punch. And then also, you know, we do know with certain diseases or disorders, like drug addiction being another one, that there's some dysfunction in these areas, that it's actually more difficult in certain cases to weigh future options as opposed to just doing something the way you've done it before or giving in to temptations and things like that. So it's a very real neurological, I guess, issue, but it doesn't mean things are hopeless or anything. You know, understanding how that process works and why you're falling into patterns, I think, at least for me, helps, you know, understand what to do about it, especially when change is difficult. But, you know, habits aren't always the best things for us. If washing dishes
right.
not to be healthy for some reason, it might be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks, Anita, for the call. Carol in Winter Park, Florida. Hi, Carol.
Hello?
Go right ahead.
Oh, good. I teach the gifted in Winter Park, Florida, elementary school, and I'm really interested in instilling better habits in them for them because they have different needs, different temperaments, and different giftedness. So I would like to know whether it's physical, is it tactile, is there a best way known through brain research to instill good habits in school? These children have to maintain in a normal public school atmosphere and all the requirements, and sometimes they have to show their work and they already know the answer. They don't know how they know it. So I need to instill good habits in them to work within a public school system.
Sure. That's a big question. You know, to instill habits is tricky business, but, you know, repetition helps a lot. And to be honest, the brain is very good at weighing sort of current rewards and things like that, and not quite as good, especially when you're young, about weighing the future. Good grades, or so-and-so will be happy, you know, in a year if you write this down now. So, you know, one possibility, you know, whether or not it works is the proof's in the pudding, but is to, you know, give little rewards. It could be a sticker or something like that, or just positive feedback for doing each aspect of what you're trying to get them to do, writing down reports and so forth. And it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can be, you know, you can piece it together, different aspects of a report or different sorts of things, each being rewarded and built together. That really can help stamp in, I think, patterns of behavior, at least sort of taking advantage of how the brain normally works. You know, that's as much as I can say. Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what are some of the big breakthroughs that you're anticipating, Professor Smith, in terms of brain imaging, in terms of making advances, in huge advances in this whole area of establishing new habits or breaking old habits?
Yeah, great question. So part of the Scientific American article is on some work we did with some new technologies. One's called optogenetics. But basically, there's this whole new field of using the sort of different profiles of different parts of the brain or different cells to your advantage to target them, to either image them or record from them or even manipulate them. And in our case, we did that with engineering the cells to express a light-sensitive receptor. And so you can shine light and turn brain cells on or off. So this is all new within the last decade, really. And what it's letting us do finally, instead of looking at habits as or habit problems as, you know, in a brain area, is to really pick apart the exact mechanism. And that's at the level we think different disorders are really happening. And this works certainly at an animal level, but also potentially down the road in terms of treating, you know, human clinical disorders that involve sort of bad habits that are unhealthy. And I sort of see that as just a major leap we're going to have or on the cusp of, really understanding things at a far more detailed level than mm-hmm. even could have dreamt a few decades ago. And that's going to certainly carry forward to understanding, you know, what to look at in human brain imaging studies. And as they develop their own ways to perturb the brain, where to target. And I think, you know, we'll find we had done some work trying to break habits with these manipulations, but also you can break them by helping your cognitive processes and willpower. And also, you know, I'm very excited about research that will try to tackle sort of stimulating the habit network to try to form newer, healthier habits, sort of, you know, I guess avoiding an unhealthy one at the same time as promoting a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, you know, between a lot of different labs sort of really going gung-ho on some of this new technology, I see just that we're going to probably have a big explosion in not only understanding the mechanisms of habits, but also the various ways to, I guess, push them around.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you, Carol. Mary Lynn is next. Hi, Mary Lynn.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm just really fascinated by everything you have to say, not only for myself, but also, as someone else mentioned, they were a teacher, and I've been one, too. But I think one of the things I've struggled with a long time is depression. I can see how I got here because I had a lot of earlier things that were really depressing that happened in my life. But one of the things that really helped me kind of gain a grasp of what's going on is to go through a lot of cognitive behavioral kinds of work with what my thoughts were and how true they were and look at the errors of my constant things that I do and my habitual thinking that bring me down. So, but I'm thinking about how much that has helped so many people by sharing that. But also, how can we help? Do you see some kinds of social values in being able to help people catch themselves in anger or catch themselves in corners where they really act out or things like that that would be helpful? Now, I realize this is, because I do agree with you, a lot of this happens just on a neurosynapse level. But what do you see happening about that? I mean, that's a long leap from where you are studying neurotransmitters, I suppose.
All right, we have about 45 seconds. Can you respond, Professor Smith? Hello? Oh, no. He's gone. Hello? I'm sorry,
oh, no,
Mary Lynn.
Can't be gone.
I'm so sorry. It just did. The phone line evaporated.
Okay. Well, thank you anyhow.
Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. And maybe we can figure out a way to get him to respond to what she had to say. That's weird, huh? Thanks to our guest for being with us, Professor Kyle Smith, Assistant Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Dartmouth College, we thank. And the article, by the way, is in the current issue of Scientific American, current until tomorrow, probably. It's the June issue, The Neuroscience of Habits, How They Form and Why They Are So Hard to Change. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, Ellen Bravo will be with us the first hour of the program. How well we care for our families, how well businesses and families interact with each other or don't is what we'll talk about. Hour one of the show, hour two, The Second Amendment, a biography. The author of the book, Michael Waldman, will be joining us. So that's that. Great conversations ahead. And news ahead in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.